It is Monday, July 6th. We are tracking a pivot in British tech policy and a series of structural shifts across global markets. Over in the Pacific, Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is in Fiji to formalize a new security treaty. This move follows a series of recent diplomatic efforts by regional powers to secure maritime and infrastructure agreements. This is standard regional competition with China, but it signals a real shift in how Australia is building its security architecture. They are looking at further developments in the Solomon Islands next. Back home, the United States is still processing the 250th anniversary celebrations. It was the first time since 1951 that a sitting president used the Independence holiday for a significant political address. That is a long time to keep the podium nonpartisan. It seems we are officially done with that tradition. Moving to Mexico, President Claudia Sheinbaum is keeping her approval rating above 70%. She is doing it by combining the populist welfare programs of her predecessor, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, with a much more technocratic management style. She is an energy engineer by trade, and it shows. The core of her support is a simple, pragmatic deal. The state provides universal health care and education subsidies to the poor and indigenous populations. In exchange, those groups keep her party, Morena, in power. It is an effective way to neutralize class-based opposition. But there is a catch, and it is a big one. Sheinbaum is relying heavily on the military to get things done. She has moved the National Guard into the Secretariat of National Defense and put the military in charge of everything from border enforcement to building infrastructure. This creates a systemic dependency. The state needs the military for the social programs to actually work. That makes it impossible to hold the military accountable for human rights abuses, including forced disappearances. Sheinbaum spent her life as an activist fighting state abuse. Now, she is the one shielding the institution accused of it. It is a classic trap. She is trading long-term democratic norms for short-term stability. Finally, NATO is undergoing a structural overhaul. The United States is shifting its focus, and that is forcing European allies to stop relying on political consensus. They have to start building their own autonomous conventional military forces. The alliance is currently strained by U.S. frustration over burden sharing. While European allies have hit the 2% GDP target for defense spending, that is not the real test. The test is turning that money into actual military assets. There is a massive gap between a budget line item and a functional tank battalion. Frontline states like Poland are worried about a 12 to 18 month window for potential Russian aggression. They do not have time for slow, bureaucratic rearmament. The alliance is now discussing a 5% GDP commitment being pushed at The Hague. The real danger here is the credibility trap. If Europe gets too capable and independent, they might move away from the U.S. security umbrella entirely. If they stay too dependent, they risk a security vacuum if the U.S. decides to pull back its troops. It is a delicate balance of trying to be self-sufficient without breaking the very alliance that keeps the peace. The upcoming Ankara summit will tell us if this is just more diplomatic noise or if they are actually fielding hardware. Everyone is talking about spending, but eventually, you have to show up with the gear. That is the only thing that actually deters anyone. Speaking of infrastructure and control, the UK is trying to play catch-up with its own AI strategy. The United Kingdom is making a move to reclaim AI sovereignty. The goal is to reduce systemic dependency on American-controlled infrastructure, which officials fear could lead to sudden access restrictions or economic decline for Britain. This push is a direct reaction to the 2014 sale of DeepMind to Google, which many in the UK now view as a strategic mistake that stripped the country of control over its own foundational research. The reality, though, is that the UK is in a bit of a bind. London has a massive cluster of AI talent, but these startups are almost universally tethered to the United States. Most are incorporated in Delaware to chase American venture capital, and the vast majority of their funding comes from stateside investors. The UK government is trying to bridge this gap with a sovereign AI fund, but those are speculative bets. Unless these companies can actually decouple from US incorporation and funding, they are likely to remain satellite outposts rather than independent powerhouses. It is a classic case of wanting the innovation without wanting to pay the rent. Meanwhile, the broader tech landscape is hitting a wall of disillusionment. Google reported a 37% increase in electricity consumption, a direct result of the massive energy demands required by generative AI data centers. This has forced companies to shift their focus from massive, general-purpose models to smaller, local, and domain-specific ones. CFOs are tired of the ballooning inference costs, so the industry is pivoting toward cost control. There is also a bit of a shell game happening with consumer hardware. Companies are using AI features to justify price hikes on laptops and smartphones, though analysts suggest the real culprit behind the high prices is potential collusion in the random access memory market. It is less of a revolution and more of a tax on your hardware. In the world of software development, the day-to-day work is changing, too. Coding tools now allow developers to write code much faster, but the constraint has shifted from technical execution to cognitive bandwidth. Developers are essentially managing multiple AI threads at once, which leads to a new kind of mental fatigue. Because large language models are trained on conventional knowledge, they tend to favor the middle of the distribution. This is a problem for anyone trying to beat the market. If you are using AI to find an edge in something like sports betting or high-frequency modeling, the AI is likely to guide you right into a consensus-based, losing strategy. The human role has essentially transitioned from a craftsman to a manager who has to decide when to trust the machine and when to intervene. This shift toward agentic AI is also changing how businesses function internally. The traditional job title is becoming less relevant than the functional archetype. We are seeing roles split into categories like prototypers, builders, and maintainers. Employees in finance or human resources can now build their own tools to solve bottlenecks instead of waiting on IT departments. This creates efficiency, but it also creates a massive governance headache. Companies are now scrambling to hire risk stewards to oversee these autonomous workflows. It sounds like a lot of corporate buzz, but the underlying point is clear. If your company gives everyone the power to build, but nobody has the job of watching what they break, you are going to have a very bad time. The takeaway here is that we are moving away from the AI will do everything hype cycle and into a frankly much more boring period of trying to figure out how to actually manage the damn things without burning the building down. From the digital frontier to the very analog world of the track, let's look at the mess at Woodbine. The Woodbine Late Pick 4 covers races 9 through 12, and it is a high-variance mess. The sequence forces bettors to navigate an inner turf bias that heavily favors forward positioning, while trying to identify which maiden class droppers actually have the legs to overcome bad draws or poor form. Race 9 is a maiden special weight on the inner turf. Speed is king here, which puts the 6 in a strong position. The 7 is a contender with strong connections, but the 8 is the real value play, provided you buy into the theory that a second start improvement combined with a jockey upgrade actually matters. The 12 is your long shot of choice, assuming you believe that gelling a horse and adding blinkers is a genuine strategy for a breakthrough rather than just throwing mud at a wall. Race 10 moves to the synthetic track for a restricted stakes sprint. The 3 is a consistent closer, but her track record in dirt sprints is shaky at best. The 8 is a primary alternative because of a weight allowance, while the 6 represents a value play based on the assumption that moving up from optional claiming company to a stakes race signals a surge in confidence from the barn. The 11th race is an optional claimer back on the turf. The 3 was dominant in her last outing, making her the logical single for your tickets. If you don't trust the favorite, the 2 is your secondary option, provided she can manage to break cleanly from the gate and avoid the traffic that has plagued her previous runs. The sequence ends with a 14-horse maiden claiming disaster. The 1 is a focus because of a barn change and the return of Lasix, Lay 6. The 4 is a first-time starter from a high-percentage trainer, which is usually where the money goes when people are guessing. The 12 has a terrible draw, but she is a class dropper with past form that makes the rest of this field look like they are standing still. Here is the thing about this sequence. You are being told that betting value is found by identifying horses undergoing environmental or equipment changes rather than looking at static past performance. It is a nice sentiment, but it feels like a lot of work to justify picking the horse with the new blinkers or the one that just switched barns. The advice is to balance these high upside plays against a single reliable favorite in the middle legs to keep your ticket costs from spiraling out of control. It is a strategy built on the hope that you can spot the one variable that makes the difference in a race full of maiden horses. That is a hell of a gamble, but at least the track is consistent. That kind of volatility isn't limited to betting windows, as we're seeing a shift in how basketball coaches handle their own influence. Gino Orema is moving into broadcasting. The UConn women's basketball coach says this shift is about more than just a job change. He believes that for women's basketball to grow, coaches have to stop guarding information like it's a state secret. He argues that total transparency prepares players for the pressure of the professional game. Orema also noted that the current discourse around stars like Caitlin Clark feels more like a national referendum than an actual basketball critique. He's concerned that this environment misinterprets standard physical play as a social conflict. It's a blunt take, which, honestly, is what you'd expect from him. Moving to the NBA, the league is currently stuck in a structural feedback loop. It isn't just the so-called second apron causing the headaches. It's a collision between aggressive labor regulations and stagnant revenue growth. Teams are looking at projections that leave them $33 million short by the 2029 season. The luxury tax is so aggressive that adding a $20 million contract can trigger over $100 million in penalties. This has turned once valuable mid-level contracts into liabilities. Front offices are now prioritizing roster churn over building a long-term core just to stay under these financial thresholds. Meanwhile, LeBron James is at a crossroads in free agency. The Golden State Warriors appear to be the most logical fit for his late career needs. They offer a high-functioning offense and a supporting cast that already knows how to win. Other teams like Minnesota or Philadelphia present trade-offs that just don't align with his current goals. Elsewhere, teams like the Boston Celtics are trying to maintain a 50-win floor by using an aggregate approach at center, betting that deep rotations are cheaper than overpaying for one marquee big man. It's all about maintaining liquidity. If you aren't managing your roster like a portfolio of tradable assets, you're basically a prisoner to the cap. In college football, the Mid-American Conference is undergoing a transformation. The league is clearly prioritizing television inventory over competitive balance, as evidenced by neutral site championship games that struggle to draw a crowd. If you're looking for value in the MAC, you have to stop looking at historical prestige. You have to look for teams with coaching continuity or those that have successfully bought their way out of talent deficits. Finally, the FIFA World Cup left a complicated legacy in the United States. While it successfully pushed soccer into the mainstream, it relied on a hyper-commercialized model that often felt exclusionary. Between high parking costs and mandatory commercial breaks, it looked a lot like a pay-to-play culture. The tournament also hit some ugly administrative snags, including visa issues that prevented officials and teams from participating. It's hard to call a tournament inclusive when your logistics are actively blocking people from entering the country. The push for transparency in sports is a nice contrast to the corporate opacity happening over at Comcast. Comcast is splitting its media assets. The company is officially separating NBC Universal from its core connectivity business. CEO Brian Roberts is carving the company into leaner, distinct entities to make them easier to sell off down the road. This isn't about growth anymore. It is about protecting the bottom line from the slow death of traditional cable. The connectivity side is feeling the heat from competitors like Starlink, which makes a future merger with a player like Charter look like the only logical move. Meanwhile, NBC Universal is shifting its focus away from the volatility of hit-driven television. They are leaning hard into the physical real estate of their theme parks, which provide reliable revenue and a high barrier to entry. Even their recent, massive spending on NBA rights looks like a play to inflate the network's value for a future buyer. It is a cold, calculated strategy. They are trading the dream of a sprawling media empire for the safety of terminal value. Axel Springer is making a different kind of bet. The company is acquiring The Telegraph to chase the center-right news consumer in the United States. They are operating on the theory that American media has drifted too far left. They see a market gap between the liberal-leaning New York Times and the institutional Wall Street Journal. The strategy relies on two main pillars. First, they plan to poach high-profile editorial talent from places like The Washington Post to build instant credibility. They need recognizable voices because nobody in the U.S. has any real brand loyalty to them yet. Second, they are looking to move away from print entirely. They want a video-forward, digital-first operation that bundles their existing properties, like Politico and Business Insider, into one massive cross-platform package. It is an attempt to export institutional brand equity across borders. They are betting that they can exploit a perceived ideological void, but it is a hell of a gamble in a market that is already drowning in content. In the creator economy, the power structure is shifting. Agencies like United Talent Agency are moving past the old model of one-off brand deals. They are acting as an infrastructure layer for influencers to build durable, multi-platform businesses. This is about turning creators into enterprises. By pushing them toward physical products, live events, and direct-to-consumer sales, agencies are trying to insulate influencers from the volatility of algorithms. If a platform changes its feed or shifts its priorities, the creator's business needs to be able to survive independently. It's a move toward platform-agnostic survival, but it comes with a major risk. When a creator starts selling products, they risk alienating the audience that followed them for pure content. The successful ones are those who can make the commerce feel like a natural extension of their narrative. If it feels like a generic licensing deal, the audience sees right through it. We are also seeing a strange inversion of media structures. Agencies are realizing that individual creators have much lower customer acquisition costs than legacy media companies. These influencers already have the community trust that traditional firms spend millions trying to manufacture. The line between being an entertainer and a marketer is effectively gone. For the next generation, consuming commercial content is just a baseline expectation. The real race now is between platform-driven synthetic efficiency, thanks to AI, and human-driven authenticity. AI can pump out volume, but it cannot build the kind of deep, long-term trust that actually monetizes. Finally, let's look at the publishing industry. It has essentially become a celebrity-driven ecosystem where ghostwriters act as the invisible, underpaid infrastructure. We are looking at a system where an estimated 60 to 70% of nonfiction bestsellers are ghostwritten. These aren't really books in the traditional sense. They are commercial products designed to monetize a pre-existing personal brand. This has created a weird, high-stakes service industry that functions more like corporate consulting than literature. The financial reality for these writers is pretty brutal. They are typically paid out of the author's royalties, which puts them at the very bottom of the food chain. They are often forced to work on breakneck deadlines for months without pay, effectively subsidizing the publisher's financial risk. When the project turns into a disaster, like we saw with Kristi Noem's memoir, it usually highlights the lack of a proper reality check. The ghostwriter is supposed to be the proxy who anticipates how the public will react. When that relationship breaks down because the author ignores the advice, the result is a public relations crisis. The modern bestseller list is less about literary merit and more about performance art. It is brand management, plain and simple. As long as the market demands rapid, celebrity-branded content, this cycle will continue. Publishers get their hit, celebrities get their platform, and the people actually writing the books get to deal with the instability of being a secondary beneficiary. It is a hell of a way to run a bookstore, but that is where we are. Of course, all this corporate restructuring eventually trickles down to the people doing the work, and nobody is feeling it more than the modern employee. Modern work culture has effectively obliterated the boundary between our professional and personal lives. Research points to a clear causal link. Constant accessibility, combined with the lingering anxiety surrounding artificial intelligence, forces our brains into a state of chronic dread. This isn't just making us tired. It is actively degrading our ability to perform, and according to recent analysis, even eroding our ethical standards. Here is the thing about stress. It works on a curve. A moderate amount of tension helps you focus, but once you cross that threshold, your emotional intelligence tanks. We start running on autopilot. We skip breaks. We ruminate on work conflicts at home, which keeps our cortisol levels high and prevents any actual recovery. When that pressure becomes the baseline, people start making moral shortcuts just to keep their heads above water. It is easy to blame the individual, but the system is rigged for this. We have been conditioned to treat productivity as the only metric of value, which leads to what some call play deprivation. When we view every hobby through the lens of market utility or professional output, we lose the cognitive flexibility required to solve actual problems. We are essentially automating ourselves into a corner. The irony, of course, is that the hustle is counterproductive. Data shows that happiness actually drives success, not the other way around. Companies that prioritize employee well-being often outperform the standard and Poor's 500. Yet, we keep chasing status symbols that provide diminishing returns once our basic needs are met. If you want to stay effective, you have to stop treating rest like a reward you earn after you have burnt out. It is a strategic requirement. You need to protect your time for non-goal-oriented play, and you need to stop waiting for your employer to fix your boundaries. That is not going to happen. Finally, we have a few other things on the docket, including some weird quirks of the human brain. The federal government is still leaning on debt-to-GDP ratios to manage its books, even though there is no actual ceiling on how much debt is too much. It is a shitty way to run a budget, because every time the economy takes a dip, the whole system starts looking like a house of cards. Electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, also known as eVTOL, are being pitched as the future of city commuting. They use rotating propellers to switch from vertical lift to wing-borne flight, which saves on battery life and makes them significantly quieter than the usual helicopter air taxis. The U.S. military has a bad habit of buying expensive, high-end gear to shoot down cheap, mass-produced drones. It is a textbook case of bad incentives, because we are burning through our strategic stockpiles just to win a math game that we are currently losing. English speakers have a weird, unconscious habit of shifting stress to the second syllable of long words. It turns out we do this just to keep a steady, rhythmic beat going while we talk, which is a hell of a thing to realize about your own brain. That is the news for today. Try to step away from the screen for a bit if you can manage it. See you tomorrow.